Beyond is sponsored by the Malone Society, the permanent utility of original texts. Go to malonesociety.com for more information. Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and this special episode discussing something that we don't necessarily discuss that often at the moment. It's a bit of a gap in our work. It's the Caroline period and more specifically music and emotion in that end of the spectrum. And I sort of have to apologise to everyone out there that, yes, we have neglected the Caroline a bit. The arrow of time is quite important, so we're starting in the medieval. We've worked our way through the Elizabethan. We're grinding our way through the Jacobean, and we are starting a sprinkling of work on the Caroline stage at the moment. So we are getting there. We are prompted to talk about the Caroline end of the universe and music, which also is another element that we slightly neglect because of the publication of a new book that is available now from all reasonable outlets of bookness. I have a wonderful guest to talk about music and emotion on the Caroline stage. My wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, I'm Dr. Shirley Bell. I'm an early career researcher specialising in early modern drama and music. And yes, I'm the author of the book Music and Emotion on the Caroline Stage, which explores the relationship between the music heard and the Caroline Theatre and the different ways actors and audience members responded emotionally to it. And yeah, I guess my purpose in life is to educate and inform people about early modern drama and music and get people excited about the Caroline period and get the repertoire better known, really, and generate enthusiasm for those plays that were performed during this largely neglected period in history.
It's because we were discussing off mic before we started that, you know, the plays we have read in our exploring sessions have generally gone down quite well. The hit rate, opposed to the disappointment rate, is quite high, and that there is a lot to be enjoyed from the period. So let's start with just asking about sort of the Caroline period in general. We're under the reign of Charles. That's the sort of demarcation we're looking at here. What makes it a bit different from earlier drama from the Elizabethan, the Jacobean?
So by the Caroline period, so around about the 1630s, most sort of new plays were being written for more sort of fashionable and restricted indoor theatres. When we think of like Elizabethan drama and early modern drama in general, we're more thinking about sort of the outdoor theatres like the Globe Theatre, really. And although there is some new stuff being written for the Globe, like the late Lancashire Witches, for example, most of the new stuff is being written for the indoor theatres. So things like the more expensive Blackfriars Cockpit and Salisbury Court theatres attracted members of the gentry, but they also attracted a mix of different social classes and were open to anyone who could afford the admission prices. But like the lower classes were not really able to sort of attend those indoor theatres like they could at the Globe. And yeah, I couldn't really afford even the cheap seats in those theatres.
Is it a bit like going to a concert today in the sense that you might save up to go once, you know, every so often?
Yeah, kind of like that. You know, it's like, you know, if you really wanted to see something that was coming out and it's like, yeah, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's not something where people could really, you know, the lower classes could really afford to kind of go regularly, you know what I mean? Mm. So in terms of playwrights, we've got Ben Jonson, who was, I mean, he wrote a lot of stuff. His most famous stuff was written during the earlier Jacobean period, like, you know, things we might know, like Volpone, Alchemist, Bartholomew Fair. But he did continue to write into the Caroline period. And we've got, you know, still a few plays coming through by him. We've got playwrights like James Shirley and Richard Broome as well. Their comedies were very sort of political and very kind of, they were commenting on the stuff of the day, you know, that kind of thing. And it was all very relatable. And that's why it was funny. And people knew, you know, like what was going on. You know, they can relate to it, really. So in terms of the music in the Caroline period, some of the musicians were actors who were also good singers and cast in specific roles that required them to sing or like play an instrument on stage. But most of the music for Caroline plays was performed by specific playhouse musicians who occupied a private area off stage. These musicians were highly skilled performers, and alongside their work in the theatre, they had employment elsewhere you know, in various other guises, like town waits, for example, you know, we were doing other things. And like the instruments used as well, we've got things like the lute, which most people know what, you know, a lute is. That was kind of the most recognisable of the plucked stringed instruments that we used on stage. But in terms of the Caroline period, that wasn't used as much. It was mainly used like as a prop, really, because it was quite a quiet instrument, particularly in the outdoor theatres. It was kind of difficult to hear, but in the indoor theatres, it was kind of easier. The way that the lute is shown on the stage, you've got things like the lute being used as an accompaniment to songs of unrequited love when you've got like a male sort of singer singing about their love. And then you've got also women playing the lute. So you've got that distinction between like you've got the sort of wealthy woman who learned how to play the lute as part of their music education. And then you've got the other side where you've got the courtesan playing the lute. Yeah, it all depends on the context of the play and what's happening and who's playing.
You were mentioning that, you know, some instruments are sort of better suited to an indoor playhouse than an outdoor playhouse, in the sense that, you know, there's some instruments are just too loud for an indoor playhouse sensibly to be played. That doesn't mean you can't unsensibly play a loud instrument in an indoor playhouse. But yeah, the something that might be more of a prop in an outdoor playhouse might actually have utility within an indoor playhouse. While other instruments are sort of available.
So you've got a lot of calls for fiddles in the Caroline drama, but the term fiddle was used to describe any sort of bowed stringed instrument like a viol or a violin. Those were usually played in consorts with other instruments or used as an accompaniment to dancing. So they could be used sort of both indoor and outdoor. But then you've got things like a hautboy or a shawm. That was quite a loud instrument and made, you know, quite a loud sound. So that was generally used more outdoor settings and played at large gatherings because it was so loud. Things like trumpets as well, they were frequently used for flourishes and fanfares and used at courtly events. And bagpipes as well. Bagpipes are one that was more associated with like rustic sort of outdoors and quite loud. And then on the other end, you've got things like recorders, which were quite like a quiet instrument and sort of tended to be more played indoors, associated with like funerals, quite a sad instrument, if you like.
It's interesting with recorders, of course, because we associate it with sort of a primary school, your first instrument. So it doesn't quite have the same connection that I think the early modern stage had for it.
Well, I suppose in schools and things, when you're just learning, it's not very particularly played very well, so obviously you've got it needs to be played well in order to be, you know, to sound, I suppose, good enough to accompany a funeral procession or something like that. Yes.
So your book, you go through a sort of a number of modes of music that are available, and give us some examples of plays where those are unpacked. And sort of, if we think of it as a set list here, because we're talking about music, you know, we have a chapter effectively on spooky music, where in the late Lancashire Witches, we have a whole host of music options. Because if you're talking about the magical universe, how do you present that in music? What instruments are you choosing? And that's an outdoor playhouse as well, play. So what's going on with the choices of music with that particular play?
So the play sort of centered around like this wedding party, this wedding mask, and you've got these witches are sort of infiltrating this this wedding, and they're trying to do all of these little things to try and kind of make it go wrong, basically. There is a lot of music that's used in this play. Firstly, you've got the wedding bells. The bell has this quite significant thing in the early modern period of like, if you're playing the bells in one order, they seem to suggest harmony and everything's sort of going well, and you know, and you kind of recognize that sound because obviously everyone goes to church and you know, you hear the church bells. Whereas in the late Lancashire Witches, we're told that the bells are playing backwards, and there is so much kind of other material on bells being played backwards on Ebo, where it suggests that the bells playing backwards is a form of danger. Mm. And it's like, oh, we should be worried about this thing. And in the play, you've got this idea of like the witches sort of making the bells play backwards. And everyone's thinking, oh, something's about to happen.
Is that a bit like playing an LP backwards and you'll hear messages from Satan?
No.
Because that was the whole thing in the 60s and 70s. Oh, wow. If you play, I can't remember which LPs it were, but if you play them backwards, you can hear Satan speaking to you or something. Oh, wow. Like that. It was one of these satanic panic things.
I think that when you're rewinding, I used to remember like rewinding tapes, and when you're rewinding them, but the sound is still on, it's like something's talking to you, but it just sounds otherworldly.
Yeah. But it's interesting that there's a sort of that this idea of you do something backwards, it's automatically sinister and wrong. And I think that's really interesting.
Well, that sort of things happening backwards seems to be a theme that goes through the late Lancashire Witches. So you've got bells playing backwards and then you've got people dancing backwards. And there's just this whole idea of backwards, and it's mentioned quite a lot. Mm. So the idea of backwards being like, oh, this is wrong.
Mm.
And we need, you know, things to be in the right order. So as the wedding carries on, we've got a group of fiddlers who come in to sort of provide the music for the wedding.
Mm.
But the fiddlers are getting really, you know, stressed because they can't play their instruments. They're trying really hard to play, and something's happening, and they don't know what's happening, and it feels like they're being controlled in some way. So you've got this, you've got the witches sort of being, you know, infiltrating their music as well. And then on the other hand, on the other side of this, you've got bagpipes, which come in a bit later on. And in a way, the bagpipes seem to be able to resist the witches. And there are all sorts of theories around about how, you know, the Lancashire bagpipe is able to resist the witches in some way, maybe because of its horrible noise, or you've got a lot of that kind of thing about the bagpipe has a horrible noise and it's monotonous and it's kind of unpleasant.
Is it like playing white noise is going to stop their demonic tunes from getting? Because, you know, who could tell if the bagpipes were played backwards?
Well, we don't know.
because it is mostly sort of a drone with, and then a tune played over it. It's like there's something unrelenting about the sound of a bagpipe.
You know, it's so powerful and loud because the fiddles are all, you know, calm and nice and melodic and stuff like that. The bagpipe isn't.
The control of fiddles as well, because you have a similar thing in The Witch of Edmonton. But also, you do have a fiddle playing cat in The Witch, so I'm just wondering if there's a fiddle association. The devil's very good at controlling fiddlers. I don't know if that's a thing.
Yes, I have talked about The Witch of Edmonton in the book about you know they're trying to play as hard as they can, but they can't, and no sound is coming out, and that's also quite unsettling. Because there's no sound, because, you know, there's so much like cacophony and the instruments are playing out of tune. And obviously that's another sign that things are not as they seem. And then, you know, suddenly the music stops, and it's quite a statement there with the music just stopping, because it would be quite unsettling for the audience to have that kind of just dramatic stop.
And the play music is really embedded in the dramaturgy of that play. Lancashire Witch is just, there's so much of it. It's not like, oh, we're now singing a song, here is a song, end of song. It is actually serving the narrative of what is happening.
Yeah, and I mean, it's quite interesting as well with the songs, because you've got like the fact that there's an incantation song towards the beginning where the witches are sort of introducing, where, you know, the play's introducing the witches, and it's like, here are all of these familiars, and they're trying to bring all their familiars on, and they're trying to set up all of the different characters who were kind of, you know, going to do all of the naughty deeds, you know. And when people start chanting in like a rhythmic way, it has that sense that, oh, something is going to happen. It's quite foreboding. It's quite scary, because you're like, especially for people who believed in the reality of witches, you know. Yeah. It's not, they can't separate the fact that they're in the theatre and they're watching a play, that these people might have magical powers, you know.
The nature of the fact, the late Lancashire witches, as in this happened quite lately, as in this is hot off the press news. So it is being presented as a dramatisation of fact, even though a lot of it is deeply fanciful. But, you know, in terms of, you know, what they're doing also with the sources, but also how fanciful are the sources. For an audience, it's going, well, this is real. Or a lot of it is.
And I think that it's quite interesting as well as the fact that that song, the Witch's Incantation song, is taken out of the play in the play script when it was printed, and it was printed at the back. Why did they print it at the back? And it's like, well, maybe they printed it at the back because people might have been using that song outside of the play to try and summon evil spirits, which I've touched on in the book. You know, because you can take things out of plays and use it. And obviously, for people who believed in witchcraft, it's like, well, you know, if you're using that, it could be quite dangerous.
Let us move on to arousing music, our next element of our set list. We've gone from spooky to arousal. And, we touched on this earlier when we were talking about instruments, about the sort of the nature of the female singer, the instrument that they are wielding, the context in which they are wielding said instrument and they are singing, and the various plays and paratexts around that shape meaning, the nature of the lute and the nature of performances also by real women as well, in at court, and the sort of overlapping areas of what's considered appropriate at the time and what disturbs people at the time, and how we might take that now. So yes, the female singer.
Yes. Yeah. So I've talked about the distinction between the two female singers. So in Shirley's plays, The Lady of Pleasure and The Bird in a Cage, two of the quite central figures are women who play lutes in very different contexts. So in The Lady of Pleasure, you've got one woman who is playing the lute and singing because she enjoys it, because she, you know, takes pleasure in it, and she's learned how to play the lute as a, you know, as a child, and she's come from a wealthy background, but she's, you know, she's not a courtesan. But then you've got a distinction in that play between another woman who is a lady of pleasure figure, who goes out and is using the lute and playing the lute to attract men, even though she's married. You've got those two side by side, but everybody's thinking the innocent woman is a courtesan because, oh, she must be a courtesan because she's presenting herself in public by playing this lute. And the whole play is very much centered around this mix of, like, getting those two characters sort of mixed up and assuming this woman is not who she says she is. And then in The Bird in the Cage, you've got another woman who is playing a lute, but she's, again, she's a wealthy woman. She's not playing in public. She's locked up in a tower because her father has told her that she's not allowed to go out and see the man that she wants to see. He's arranged for her to marry somebody else, but she doesn't want to marry this person, so he's punished her by locking her away. So then she's kind of playing the lute in her tower where she's locked, just to entertain herself. And her maids are like there with her as well. So there's this whole thing about how they're locked away. They're in a domestic setting, but actually, by performing on stage, these women are showing themselves to an audience and they're playing lutes. What does this mean? And there's a lot of overlay in that play about that iconic image of the lady playing the lute, and what does that mean, and what does that say about these women?
You know, obviously, we're talking about a deeply patriarchal society that is incredibly judgy about all of these things. You mentioned William Prynne, one of our favourite commentators from the period. Let's not pretend that people aren't still incredibly judgy about women who sing in public today, and that actually there's a astounding sort of little parallels that sort of crop up when you're looking at those. That's sort of looking forward to covering these plays when we actually do first looks on them, of actually that speaks still to us today about those contradictions and those just those judgments made by society and men, and where do you place these conceptions of respectability?
Yeah.
I mean, don't think that was a question. I'm sorry. It's a summary.
It's just so deeply rooted in the from generation to generation. Mm. You know, men have judged women for appearing in public and showing themselves. You know, and also, like, in this chapter, I talk about two other women in Johnson's The New Inn, where it's literally like they're not even appearing playing an instrument. They are just there. And you've got men who are sort of judging them and sexualizing them and objectifying them just for appearing. It's just there. And it's there's this whole idea in those plays about, can you know what a woman is like just by looking at her, even if she's not doing anything? Yeah, and there's a distinction between, like, there's one, I suppose you've got the innocent woman and the not so innocent woman. So you've got one who's just like, who's presented as this kind of perfect, pure figure, you know, and the main protagonist sort of is idolizing her and as though she's this beauty and she's this, that, and the other. And then on the other hand, you've got this other woman who comes in wearing posh dresses and, you know, trying to be all fancy and everything. And there's two people who comment on her about how she's a lady gay. And there's all that stuff about the distinction between what does that mean? And that kind of, is she a posh lady because she appears in these dresses, or is she a courtesan? But actually you find out that she's kind of, her husband makes dresses for wealthy people and she tries them on and they sort of, you know, do their business. And then he takes their dresses back to the people they're actually made for. So there's a whole lot of stuff about women and representations of women and what men think about women.
Well, I think that brings us to the next element of our set list of melancholy music, which is very much about, we were talking about women, you know, sitting there playing their stringed instrument. Let's talk about men and their stringed instruments, and the differences, the immediate differences that are coming out there about, you know, this sexual frustration and sadness. Yes. I think the juxtaposition of the two is really interesting, of just actually how different that presentation is of the male and the female there. So gendered melancholy.
Yes. And in the three plays that I look at in this chapter as well, the different types of melancholy are so different, and the way people express their melancholy. So you've got one in The Court Beggar, you've got this guy who is sort of in love with this woman who obviously has rejected him, and he's doing everything he possibly can to kind of get her, and the more she rejects him and the more frustrated he gets, and he pretends to be a fool to get close to her and then tries to attack her, and it's all very unpleasant. And then you've got things like, oh yeah, the Antipodes, you've got one guy who is neglecting his wife. They haven't consummated their marriage and she's getting really frustrated. But he's like, oh, I so want to travel. I'm so obsessed with traveling that I'm just going to dismiss her. And then you've got the Sad Shepherd, where you've got someone who thinks his beloved has died, and he's so, like, kind of sad and, you know, emotional, and that grief type of sadness where he's just so distraught that he's lost his beloved.
Yes, the unrequited love and grief are actually very similar in their presentation.
Yeah, it's strange, because you've got this idea of that courtly love sort of tradition of, like, this obsession with the person, and but then you've got, like, oh, it's genuine in the Sad Shepherd, because the guy genuinely thinks he's lost his beloved. Eglamour, the guy who's lost his beloved, Eglamour sort of, on one hand, sort of suggests equality and the fact that it will be a return to equilibrium, in that she will appear from the dead at the end, and it will be all happy again. But then you've got this idea of it being actually Aiglemore suggests lovesickness also. Mm. I think it's the French meaning of that. Mm. Someone mentioned this at a talk I gave the other day, and I was like, oh, actually, because you've got that distinction between the way he's acting, it feels like a representation of lovesickness, but actually he thinks his beloved has died, so that's sort of grief as well.
And in a sense, it, and it's also a sort of double grief, because, of course, he doesn't get his resolution at the end because the play is incomplete.
No. It never finishes.
Yeah, so he's still wandering around being sad. It's such a shame, because actually I really quite enjoy the play that is extant, and it's actually a real it's very rare for me to say, Ben Johnson, could you write some more? We are running a little low on time, but we have some calming music and the vital importance of listening to the lyrics.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that with calming, also just to sort of link those two together from the melancholy to the calm, is that idea that music could be used as a treatment for melancholy and make the characters calm. So in the Antipodes, you've got they play the music to him, and he becomes calm, and he does regain his sense of self, I guess.
Which isn't wholly medically unsound. I mean, you think that, you know, in the sort of dealing with people with dementia or the use of music as a stimulus is something that does seem to work and does have some sort of actual grounded effect. So I'm wondering if actually that's a sort of early modern acknowledgement of that music's power.
I mean, I think it does work as well. Because I find that when I'm stressed and I listen to certain types of music, it does calm me down. There is something in that. And when you're calm, it allows you to, you know, listen to things carefully and be a discerning listener and not be deceived by things, as we get in the staple of news in Hyde Park, where you've kind of got that idea where you have to, like, sort of listen carefully and not believe everything that you hear. In the staple of news, you're thinking about money and the ways that you spend money, and the central character has been given a lot of money because his father has supposedly died, even though he's in disguise and he's just pretending to be dead so that he can see what his son is doing with the money. So, and it's this sort of temptation of the son where he's like, he's got all this money and he can spend it on whatever he likes, and his father's seeing whether he will spend all the money or whether he will be sensible. So it's like that idea running through it of, like, is he going to be sensible or is he going to do what his father thinks he'll do? And then you've got Hyde Park, where it's all about different couples and how they respond to each other and whether their relationship's going to work or not, and whether they're listening to each other or whether they're just doing what they want. And this whole thing about listening to birdsong and the different birds are deciding whether they will be together. So you've got the distinction between the nightingale's call and the cuckoo's call. If they hear the nightingale, then they're destined to be happy. If they hear the cuckoo, it's like a relationship will not work. Do you ignore that? You've got characters ignoring the cuckoo and then their relationship not working and them not taking heed of that. And then you've got the ones who are listening to the nightingale, and it's like, oh, the nightingale. Yes, we will be happy.
Yes, beware the sound of the cuckoo.
Yes.
So to sort of wind us up, all of the words used to describe the effects that music has to beguile, to charm, to calm, to trick, to excite, you know, the music has definite effects on people, that it's used both as an idea but also as part of the dramaturgy. It's there for effects, but it's also to tell stories. It's doing a whole job of work that maybe we're not quite dealing with well enough in production and in work on it, and which I'm going to put my hand up and say I'm very guilty of that as well. I mean, the problem with music is really expensive. But yeah, maybe we're just not actually fully appreciating what we can be getting out of music in drama.
Yeah, I mean, it's doing so many different things, and it does tend to be like sort of cast off and just oh, it's just that thing that, you know, that makes it a bit more entertaining and fun. But actually, it's quite a big thing. It's crucial, actually, to a lot of the drama, a lot of the things that happen, because a lot of the lyrics particularly speak to the action, or there's things in the lyrics that you wouldn't even get from the dialogue. But then if you cut the song out altogether, it's like, well, then it's giving it a different meaning.
Mm.
And even like the types of music that's used, that has a significance as well as the lyrics. There's so much going on.
And of course, we have gaps, because sometimes we don't get the lyrics, and a lot of the time we don't have the music to go with the lyrics. So there's a whole series of questions about, okay, is the music, because you know what it's like with songs. It's like there's so many really cheerful, happy, boppy songs, and you listen to the music, the lyrics, and go, hang on, this is quite dark, really.
Yeah.
And that contradiction is, again, important for what you're doing on stage.
Yeah, and I think that like the whole purpose of that distinction between the happy, it's kind of somebody has made a decision as to why that is happening, and you know, that's important. It's not just there. When there's a gap where it just says song or music, there's a lot of interpretation there, so somebody's got to be like, what would be appropriate to use here? So it's up to sort of the people directing it to be like, you know, to interpret that, but it doesn't always work very well, particularly if you're, I suppose, in terms of like popular song, if you're using a popular song, like a popular ballad from the early modern period, and then you're using a popular song from whenever you're staging it, it does have a similar effect, because it's, you're using a popular song, but I suppose it's up to whoever's directing it to make that decision.
Well, it's like, you know, cliches of, you know, in music, it's like Barber's Adagio for Strings, which is sort of this, has become this sort of very cliched thing because of its use in a film. But you think the early modern period, using Fortune, My Foe, it is almost like a shorthand for a certain kind of effect you want the audience to get straight away. You know, these needle drops that we get in drama today, it's like, you know, there's certain things that get used again and again and again because we know it works, therefore everyone automatically gets it.
Yeah, yeah. In the Antipodes, when they just literally say, sing Fortune, My Foe, there's a whole heap of context that comes in which wouldn't have been in there if that lyric was cut out. So it needs to be in there. And if you cut it out, it's like, well, all that comedy that comes out of that wouldn't be there.
And for a modern production, it's a matter of, can you find an analogue which will have the same emotional impact on an audience today? Because nobody today would necessarily get the importance of Fortune, My Foe, whereas if you find an appropriate song that says the same sort of thing, then you might get that to work. But then you have the problem of slightly the jarring of the modern and the early modern. That horrible tightrope that we walk.
I find that, you know, in like pantomime where you kind of, particularly if there's a celebrity who is in the lead role or something, and they're just doing the action and everything, and then suddenly somebody walks in and sings a line of, if they're a singer, like a song that they've done or something like that, and then it's just like, oh, that whole thing, you know, about who that person is, and you've got, everybody gets it.
And it's also, again, looking at all of these plays as a group. Of course, you know, this is a continuum of quite regular theatre goers. So a lot of these things overlap and the culture of the time. And again, how do we recreate that for us today? Well, one of the answers to that is just keep putting on all of the plays so that the people keep watching them and then they become normal. But that's my mission.
We should stage more Caroline plays. There's hardly any... I suppose there isn't, like, people don't really know them. That's why they don't stage them. But then it's like, but how are people going to know them if they don't stage them? So,
yeah. I mean, from our perspective as producers, the hit rate is very strong for Caroline Drama in terms of people going away going, I really enjoyed that. Let's put that on. There was just a production of The Sisters, which is a very late Caroline play. In America, which was sort of bounced off one of our exploring sessions, which was very pleasing. So from our perspective, I you know, they're relatively slam dunks, a lot of them, because we don't have many really viable comedies, because so many comedies are not actually very funny. And a lot of the Carolina are a lot more joyful. I wonder if it's sort of the bias of the Academy against the Caroline is because, to be fair, there isn't necessarily that much innovation. It's there's a lot of this is a bit like a play from 20 years earlier. Done really well, but, and this sense of, well, therefore it's not as something that people want to study in the same way as this is the first time that a thing has appeared and this is its its acme. And I wonder if there's a sort of bias against it. It's not about the quality of the plays, it's about their impact of originality. Where a lot of these plays where it is literally you can sit there and go, it's a bit like this play and this play. There's a bit of a shopping list quality to Caroline drama. But from my perspective, that's not a problem.
Oh, no.
At all. Sorry, I was wittering on there. About your book and where we can find it.
Yes, so my book is Music and Emotion on the Caroline Stage. It covers all the things that we've been discussing here and more, and it's out now. So you can get it from the Palgrave's website, but also any other bookshops has got it. So it's the first book to explore the relationship between music and emotion in the Caroline Theatre, and it discusses all the ways that music was used to provoke and control and direct emotions.
Yeah, and links to all that will be in the show description, so you'll be able to find that. And if you're looking in the future, depending when you're listening to this, if you're listening to it now, it's reassuringly expensive, and in the future it might be slightly more reasonably expensive. But that is the nature of academic publishing. Do look it out in your local library. That is also an option, or in fact ask your library to stock it. Well, any final thoughts before we close?
I just wanted to say as well that I want my book to be an example to other PhD students that turning your PhD thesis into a book is possible. We always get told that it's not possible and, oh, you should split it into articles. But no, I did it. So, yeah, try.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Beyond is sponsored by the Malone Society. The Malone Society is dedicated to textual scholarship in late medieval and early modern drama. It publishes editions of early printed and manuscript texts of plays, plus collections of documentary material relating to the performance and reception of early drama, offers research fellowships, grants and prizes, and supports symposia and performances. For more details, visit malonesociety.com.